Hello and welcome to The Reset, a mental health podcast without all the bollocks. I'm Sam Delaney. My guest this week is Alex Messenger. In 2005, when he was aged just 17, Alex was on a canoeing trip with some pals in the Canadian wilderness when he was attacked by a 600-pound grizzly bear. He almost died, but eventually recovered. However, his story is one of drama, adventure and trauma, a trauma that Alex still lives with today, and which he has written an account of in his brilliant new book, The 29th Day. I was delighted he joined me from his home in America to talk about the mental health impact that this incident had on him and his life. I hope you enjoy listening to our chat. Alex Messenger, welcome to The Reset.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for sparing the time to speak to us all the way from Duluth, Minnesota today. By Lake Superior. Sounds absolutely gorgeous part of the world. And, you know, one of my first questions was going to be, you know, when we go back to this sort of, you know, crucial turning point moment, I guess, in your life, you were on a kayaking trip with a bunch of your buddies, right? So you're clearly someone who enjoys adventure. Is that what you've always been like?
You know, I've always been into adventure. You know, for me, it's a canoeing trip. I don't know if that's, you know, a critical thing to switch to, but I've always been into adventure and getting outside. And I really owe that to my parents. You know, they kind of instilled in me this idea that it's okay to be outside of your comfort zone and to be experiencing these amazing things. So they taught me that through traveling internationally when I was young. They both were working at university at the time, and so we got to go on trips with them, my sister and I, and then they started taking us out into the wilderness, and that just really spurred this love of being outside and of kind of these crucible experiences where you're put into a situation where you have to deal with stressors and kind of overcome challenges. And I think that's a big part of what has driven me to continue those experiences throughout my life.
Is that what kind of positive impact does that have on your mental health, do you feel, in sort of normal life, so to speak?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think anytime you are in a space where you can kind of disconnect and slow down, you know, take a minute to change your perspective, I think that's really helpful. You know, for me personally, being able to be in a place where you're not getting bombarded with all those usual, you know, alerts and time constraints and things, and where you're able to focus on what's in front of you, I find that very cathartic and restorative. You know, even it's kind of funny, because when you look at these experiences, a lot of times you're dealing with some major challenges, you know, physical or just mental, you know, combining those two as well. But the amount that you get back from a trip like that is just amazing. You know, a lot of people talk about with the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in northern Minnesota here. That's where I really started my wilderness stuff. But they talk about how, you know, they have to go every year or however often they go, and it's like a critical part of their restoring themselves. And I completely agree.
But just the resilience and the lessons learned from putting yourself or taking yourself out of your danger zone on those kind of trips, does that help when you're living, when you go back to the ordinary life of being at home, paying bills, fielding emails, and all the other stuff that people just have in day-to-day life? Does it help you cope better, do you feel?
I do. I feel like the perspective that you gain when you learn more about yourself and you learn more about what you're capable of, that completely translates. You know, picking up a heavy pack and portaging it over miles, you know, that's very different, of course, from having a stressful project at work that you have to power through. But there's a lot of overlap in that kind of mental fortitude and recognizing when something's challenging, where you go to find that energy and to find that spark to continue that work. So I think that's a big part of it, outside of just the feeling like your tank is refilled from going on a trip like this. You come back with some tools that are kind of embedded in you and more in your subconscious than anything that you can apply.
Alex, take us back to July 2005. Why were you in the Canadian Northwest? Where exactly were you? Who were you with? What was going on?
Yeah, so in 2005, I was 17 years old and I was on the pinnacle trip with YMCA Camp Minojin. We were on our 52-day session. We were going to be on trail for 42 days, whitewater canoeing over 600 miles in the remote wilderness of northern Canada from the Northwest Territories through Nunavut Province. So this is a trip that we had all worked up towards for years. This was my fourth trip, and for the other guys, it was at least that many, if not more. So each year we went on a longer and longer trip, and built our skills and our experience, and were invited back, year after year to come finally to this pinnacle journey. So we were paddling on a few different river systems, the Dubawnt, Kunawak, and Kazan, and basically completely unsupported on this journey to this tiny little town at the end of our route called Baker Lake, which is 1,000 miles north of the US-Canadian border. So it's just this very remote space that is, you're not likely to see anyone else the entire time you're out there. And so it's just everything that we'd worked on for years prior to this, but on a completely different scale.
Is and was that level of remoteness from anywhere, from healthcare, emergency support, any of that stuff, was that scary to you, or is that something that you 100% embraced? Is that why you were there?
100% is a pretty intense number,
Yeah.
but I was very into it, and I had experienced wilderness on a scale where you are completely reliant on yourself and your teammates, but the scale of this one was on a whole nother level. I mean, I think the most poignant example of that was we just drove and drove to the end of the road to start this trip. And then at the end of the road, we got into a bush plane and we flew for hours before getting dropped off on this lake in the middle of nowhere. The entire time we were flying, there was nothing around except
Wow.
for, undeveloped land. And so when we landed and got all our stuff out and got ready to wave bye to the pilots, that's like when it really started to sink into me how remote we were. And when they flew off, it kind of was this pit of the stomach feeling like, okay, am I making the right decision? Like I'd never had that suddenness of being out there. With every other trip, we made our way gradually to the place where we'd be launching, and you'd paddle away, and if you forgot your socks, you could turn around and come back. And with this one, you just don't have that same thing. Like the level of commitment is just so much more intense. But after those butterflies left and I settled into the surroundings, I was just really, focused and ready to go. And that was a feeling that, I fell into that familiarity of having been down that before. And that was good because that those butterflies were pretty intense.
Okay, I bet. But on your list of things to sort of feel at all anxious about,
Yeah.
was encountering a bear particularly high?
We were aware of bears in the area we were going to be traveling in. And so that was on our list of concerns and things that we were prepared for. There were a lot of other things that we had on our list. We were worried about, with whitewater, especially where we were, it was really cold water. There's a lot of risks that you have to manage to make sure that you don't end up in the water. And if you do end up in the water, you know what to do, and you're able to respond to, you know, challenges like the cold and hypothermia and things like that. And there's myriad things that can happen on the river. So we'd gone through a lot of training for that. You know, we were worried about other large mammals up there. We had a substantial med kit, and our guide Dan was a wilderness first responder, so he had a lot of training as well to deal with medical and trauma issues in an austere environment where you're away from definitive medical care. And you know, with bears, we were going to be outside of the grizzly territory for the first few weeks of the trip, and then we were going to enter grizzly territory. So we had a plan for how we'd set up camp. We'd gone through all these different, you know, tools that we had with us. Like, we had bear spray, which is like a little fire extinguisher that shoots mace like 40 feet to use as a deterrent if you have a close encounter with the bear. We had bear poppers, which is a loud noisemaker that's intended to scare the bear away if it's a little bit further. And, you know, how we conduct ourselves when we encounter a bear. But the actuality is, like, the density of bears in this area, even once we got into their home range, it's such a low density. You're really not likely to see a bear. We've been told by folks who'd been there numerous years that you're lucky if you see a grizzly bear when you're up there. So, you know, not likely that we're going to see one at all. We were going to be north of the tree line by the time we entered this area. And so the likelihood of stumbling upon one is even lower, because you can see for forever. I mean, this isn't really mountainous. It's mostly flat. So the line of sight is just incredible. So we were prepared for them. We weren't expecting to necessarily see any, and we weren't expecting certainly to stumble upon one.
So the day that you did, you wandered away. Is that right? You wandered up towards a peak that had a very famous view from the top of it. Is that why you wandered away from your group?
Yeah. Well, the reason I wandered away from the group was because everyone was going up to the top of this ridge, which was just behind our camp for that day on day 29. And when they all went up, I was really tired. And so I decided that I was going to take a nap while they all went up there, and that I would meet them when I woke up. And I overslept. And by the time I got up, the only person left up there was Dan, and he was on his way back. So I ended up heading up there myself because everyone else was back, and, you know, I still wanted to go up there. And we didn't feel like there was any risk with my going up there. You know, they'd just been there minutes before. It's the highest point around. You can see every lake for probably 50 miles in every direction. And so the idea of something lurking and suddenly appearing just was kind of outside of our paradigm right then.
Tell me about the moment you first realized you were in the presence of a bear then.
Yeah, so I got to the top of this ridge, and I was walking away from camp towards the areas that the guys had told me about. And I was just kind of in my own head walking up these rolling granite domes, and I didn't know it, but there was this 600-pound barren ground grizzly bear walking up the other side of one of these ridges, and we were walking straight towards each other. So that first instance that I realized that I was in the presence of something besides just me and my own thoughts was when I saw this little flash of brown fur on the horizon just out of the corner of my eye, and my body instantly flashed into this kind of very central part of my brain and experience where it's alerted to movement in the distance, well, not so far distant. And I instantly thought, oh no, this is a muskoxen. This is a really bad situation. And then another fraction of a second later, and the head of this grizzly bear came up over the ridge, and I realized that it was not a muskox, it was a grizzly bear, and it was a much worse situation than stumbling on a muskoxen. So I made that recognition, and the bear, its head snapped up, and we kind of both had the same reaction, which was, oh my gosh, what am I looking at? And so I flashed back to that training, what we've been told to do when we see a grizzly bear. I imagined pulling the bear spray out of its holster and removing the safety and aiming it and firing it, but I didn't have it with me. That was not our practice to carry them. So this bear deterrent that we had was in our tents and not usable. So that was a big that was a big challenge. And I then flash back to that training. And so I had Dan's voice in my head, you know, saying, speak calmly to the bear, avoid eye contact, back away slowly, and whatever you do, don't run. And that was most what I wanted to do, was just run away and get away from this bear. But I had that training and I knew that's what I couldn't do. So I started backing away slowly and averting my eyes. And I said, hey, bear, whoa, bear, it's okay, bear. And it basically started into some bluff charges. And so it was looking at me, and it would launch forward on its front paws and grunt and be like, and I kept backing away slowly, trying to speak calmly to this bear and convince it that it didn't need to worry about me and that we could part ways. And basically it faded from stationary bluff charges to a full speed charge. And it was just this 600 pound apex predator grizzly bear against this 17-year-old 150 pound kid with basically nothing. And that's when it was just apparent that this was going to get much worse very quickly.
So when you spotted it first, how many yards was it when you first saw it?
When I first saw the bear, it was about 10 yards, 30 feet away.
Wow.
So super close. Wow. Basically, yeah. When your closing distance is that short, that forces the hand of the bear and it has to decide, you know, fight or flight. And it's essentially too close for it to run away. It can't.
So the bear didn't see you as prey as much as a threat that needed to be eradicated.
Exactly. Yeah. I was a threat that had to be eliminated. And that's what it was going to do. You know, it was going to see how I responded to those initial bluff charges and then escalate as needed.
Once you realized it was charging at you for real, what happened then?
So I realized that it was coming at me and it wasn't going to stop. It was kind of like I could see this switch flip in the bear's, you know, consciousness, to anthropomorphize it a bit. But I didn't know what to do at that point other than not run away. You know, people talk about playing dead, and that just, it didn't cross my mind at that point. And so as I'm backing away slowly, I escalated from hey bear, whoa bear to yelling obscenities and help and trying to alert my trip mates, who, you know, overall weren't too far away, but up with the ridge and the distance and the wind, they didn't hear anything. They had no idea that anything was going on top of this ridge, despite this cacophony of what the bear was doing and the grunting and the and me yelling. And when it was 5 or 10 feet from me, just coming at me full speed, I could feel the ground shaking under its paws with its gallop.
Wow.
And I had my Pelican case, which is like a 15-pound brick of camera, in my hand, and just like on intuition, I cocked my hand back and I chucked that underhand, and it's the only time I'll throw my camera. It's also the only time a throw mine hit something it was supposed to, because I was a terrible shot at the time. But I just launched that underhand and I hit the bear square in the nose with enough force to turn its head all the way to the side. And so the Pelican case went tumbling over its shoulder and it grunted from the impact. And for a couple of its steps, it couldn't see where I was because its head was turned in the other direction. And so I was able to jump out of the way and dodge it bullfighting style on that first pass, and just, you know, barely missed each other. And I wasn't thinking at all about that. It just was kind of happening on instinct. And as soon as it realized that it had missed me, it's got its head turned back around. It turned its body back towards me for a second pass. And I've never seen anything move as quickly as that bear did, turning around to come at me again.
Wow. So it's a surprisingly agile creature for something so gigantic.
Yeah, it's crazy how quickly they can move. And swing that body around. I mean, that's a huge amount of mass, but you know, they're used to it. It's kind of like watching a, I don't know, a really good football player just step and pivot, but that doesn't even come close to describing it.
You think that bag, that sort of almost one in a million shot of your Pelican bag at the bear's head, saved your life?
It could have. I mean, it certainly gave me the little bit that I needed to get out of its way. I mean, I imagine if I hadn't done that, that it just would have barreled me over on that first pass and just taken me down. And, you know, just being thrown down from that would have been really bad. And then I'm sure it would have launched into whatever attack it had been planning to incapacitate me, which I think would have been more grievous than what ended up happening.
So what did happen at second pass? It turned, ran at you again, and what happened that time?
Yeah, so it came at me again, and I basically was able to bullfight it like that for another few passes. So it would come at me, and I would jump out of the way at the last second, and we got closer and closer every time. And each time it would get me a little bit with its claws, and it would snap at me with its jaws, and I couldn't tell what impact those were having on me, but I felt them. And then finally, it snapped at my leg with its jaws on like the fourth pass or so, and I pulled my leg out of the way at the last second, and its teeth just snapped shut inches from my leg with like this big crack sound. And at that same moment, it reached up with its paw and it hit me across the face. And I remember seeing that just inches from my face and thinking, oh no, this is about to hit me. And when it did, I was just like a mosquito getting swatted out of the air and just grunted from the impact, and realized with that amount of force how unfair of a fight this was. And how I just didn't provide any resistance to this bear. It was so much more powerful than I was. And my head whipped to the side and I went flying to the side. And as I was in mid-fall, it had its paw around me and it threw me down to the ground hard on my tailbone. And at the same instant, it had its head right at the top of my leg and it had its teeth around my thigh, just below the hip joint. And it clamped down. And people are like, so did the adrenaline rush take care of the pain? Well, it didn't. I felt its teeth go in both sides of my leg and then
Wow.
blacked out. And I'd as this had all been unfolding, I'd kind of shifted from help and bear and obscenities to just yelling no, because I felt like I was about to die, and that was just like such a horrible feeling for me. And it just felt like such loss, and like it wasn't how things were supposed to be happening. And then that all unfolded and the lights went out.
So you blacked out, and when you came round, what did you find?
Well, when I came around, it came in flickers first. So I didn't just like open my eyes. I kind of started to perceive the grass and everything was kind of spinning. And when I finally got my equilibrium and saw the horizon, I realized that I wasn't dead. And it was just this feeling of elation and excitement and confusion because I didn't really know what was going on. But I was really excited that I wasn't dead, that I was still up on that hill. And I scanned the horizon from where I'd finally found it and saw that the bear was still there. And I froze at that point and was just immediately filled again with dread. But this bear was running away and it was looking at me the entire time that it was running away. So it was heading back in what looked like the direction it had come and just going from shoulder to shoulder to keep an eye on me. And at this point, I played dead consciously. So I'd been playing dead really effectively when I was unconscious. So I didn't want the bear to think that I was back in it, that not that I was in the fight, but that I was, you know, conscious and that there was anything else for it to do. So I played dead consciously, you know, kept my eyes averted, but so I could still see it out of the periphery of my vision, and just waited there for this bear to go back over the ridge and for it to not be able to see me if I started moving again, and just hoped against hope that it didn't notice that I was doing anything and didn't think that it had to come back and finish the job.
And so that's how you knew this bear wasn't hungry. This bear, and it wasn't as if it was sadistic either, because it just wanted to do what was required, really, to get you out of its path.
Right. I mean, you know, there's a few different kinds of encounters. There's a predaceous encounter where the bear sees someone as food, and that's a whole nother level of horrifying. You know, people might wake up being dragged back to a den or something, or not wake up at all. You know, mother with cubs, and that's a different situation. And this is a very like classic defensive encounter where the bear saw me as a threat. And so that threat needed to get eliminated to ensure the safety of the bear. So once it had achieved that mission and I was down and out on the ground, you know, it kind of said, all right, I can leave now. I've defended myself. So if it had seen me moving again, there's a very good chance that it, you know, would have come back and been like, oh, it needs another tussle. So, you know, it's possible that it could have changed its mind and realized that this was an opportunistic food source. So I'm really glad that it didn't. But yeah, just as soon as it was done, it was ready to go and head back and put some ice on its snout from that pelican case or something.
So how long did you wait lying there and playing dead before you called out for help?
I don't know how long I was waiting. I mean, it was probably, you know, a matter of something counted in seconds. But I waited until it had gone back over the ridge and it had gone far enough so that if I stood up completely, it wouldn't be able to see at all, you know? So I would guess that was like 15, 30 seconds, but it was the longest 15 or 30 seconds that I waited, because all I wanted to do was get out of there. And I just waited and waited. But I didn't want to wait so long that if it, you know, decided to come back, I was still there. So I wanted to leave as soon as I could.
So did you call for your friends to come to you, or were you able to drag yourself down to where they were?
I was able to get back on my own. I was worried that if I made a sound, the bear would realize that I was still there and it would come back. So at this point, I was being as quiet and stealthy as I could. So I got up, I felt my leg. By now, my adrenaline was just going crazy and it was masking everything. Everything was kind of dull. And I felt my leg and it was wet. And I thought, oh no, because if that's that much blood, I'm really in bad shape. And I looked at my hand and it wasn't blood. It was bear saliva all gooey between my fingers, which was much better. And so I grabbed the things that I could see that I dropped. I grabbed my pelican case. For some reason, I grabbed the book that had fallen out of my pocket. And I started running back to camp, which was 200 yards away as the crow flies. And the last 50 were 100 vertical feet down. That's the ridge that I'd climbed up to get to this plateau at the top. And the whole time I was going back there, I was trying to be as quiet as I could. And I was checking over my shoulders to see if the bear was coming back to finish the job. And I was just hoping that I was going in the right direction, because I was so turned around. There's a very good chance that I could get to where I thought camp was, and I could look down and see some ridge that's completely unfamiliar to me. I could have been running in the wrong direction. The bear could have been running towards the guys, you know, I didn't know. So I was just hoping that I was headed back towards them. And then once I saw them and knew that they'd actually hear me, if I yelled, then I could yell to them for help and, you know, I wouldn't be alone anymore. And so I finally got to this ridge and I looked down and I saw the canoes, and then I saw the tents, and I saw the guys sitting in the bug tent, and I knew at that point that I could yell for them. And I checked over my back one more time to make sure that the bear hadn't snuck up behind me, and I yelled down. I said, "Bear!" And they said, "Whatever, Alex." They thought I was playing a joke on them, a pretty sadistic joke.
Yeah.
I said, "Bear." They said, you know, basically they didn't believe me, and I kept yelling down to them, and I said, "No, I got attacked by a bear," and every other word was an expletive, which I won't I won't say here, but I was like, I don't care if these guys believe me or not. I need to get down this ridge so that they can start tending to my wounds, because I was like basically dragging my foot. I didn't know what my injuries were. I just knew I had to get back to camp, and I just was filled with this adrenaline rush and this energy to do that, and then they could take care of the rest. And so I was running down this ridge as best as I could, and I was like, Dan's going to need to know what my injuries are so he can start planning. I was like, I got attacked by a bear, and I got hit in the face, not if I'm cut, and I got bit in the thigh, and there's blood on my foot for some reason, and I don't know why. So I was wearing sandals, and my other foot was covered in blood, and my foot that wasn't working right was not covered in blood. I didn't know what exactly was going on. But going down that as quickly as I could, it took me about 10 minutes to scramble up this ridge, and it took me about a minute to get down.
And were you bleeding profusely? Was that going to be an issue? Were you losing a lot of blood?
I was bleeding. I would not call it profuse. I would say significant or heavy bleeding. You know, we had to take care of that blood loss and make sure it didn't get worse. But it was really scary how close it was, because one of the canines went in all the way right next to my femoral artery. And if it had hit that, which was a quarter inch away, if it had hit that, I would have been bleeding profusely. It would have been spurting with my pulse. And then after just a few minutes, I would have died from blood loss. So right next to that, so I had a bunch of like venous and capillary bleeding from that, that we were able to control pretty well with, you know, direct pressure and dressings. So
can you recall what kind of mental state you were in at that moment, and that of, you know, the people around you, your friends? Was it disbelief, or were you, you know, what sort of state do you go into? Does adrenaline just make you think in practical terms about survival?
I'd say I was in this very practical state until I was under the care of others. And, you know, that's something that I've heard other people talk about too, where, you know, you keep going as long as like you have to, as long as it's on you to do that. And obviously it's dependent on a lot of factors, but you do what you can. And then once you reach care with other folks, your body kind of steps back a little bit because it's been using these incredible reserves to get you to that point. And I experienced that. So I got to Dan, and by the time I got to him, I couldn't move my leg anymore. I was actually moving my leg with my arms the last however far on the hill. So I was definitely in bad shape, and just couldn't move my leg anymore. And, you know, I was in in that logistical handoff, this is what needs to happen mode, until he laid me down on the mat and he started doing his head to toe assessment. And I kind of realized, you know, I guess subconsciously that, okay, he's got it from here. And I started to shift into, that sort of disbelief and recognition of the gravity of what had just happened. And that was very overwhelming for me, because I, you know, I hadn't been thinking about that very much other than, you know, when I was about to die and or feeling like I was about to die and experiencing the emotions with that. But then when I got back to the ground and he was working on me, I started to realize the ripple effects of this experience and the impact that it would have, or that it could have had more specifically, on everyone that I knew or had interacted with. I mean, you know, when you lose someone, especially when you lose them traumatically, it impacts those around you. You know, of course it impacts the guys on the trip. And this impacted the guys on the trip, but you know, if I had not made it, you know, all of my classmates would have been impacted by that. My family, you know, like it just kind of keeps going. And I didn't have my life flash before my eyes, especially not up on the hill. Everything was very focused on what was happening. But when I got back down there and started kind of feeling that ripple effect, I started to see pictures of all the people that I knew. And they just started flipping through as if on a Rolodex, and it just went faster and faster. And that was overwhelming. And I started to, like, I don't know if I was hyperventilating, but I started to feel really faint and and just, yeah, overwhelmed by recognizing the impact of what had just happened to me and how it could have impacted everyone else.
And so then you had to, what, you had to work out how you were going to get to proper professional medical attention, but you were miles away from civilization, effectively. So what did you decide to do?
Yeah, that was a big challenge. And I mean, we had a satellite phone with us, so we had the ability to communicate. They didn't have really like the spot beacons and things. They had EPIRBs back in the day, which are kind of the equivalent that sailboats used to use. But we had satellite phone, which allowed us two-way communication. And we found out, once Dan was able to communicate with camp, that basically a helicopter was not available. And that's kind of the go-to. The next options were going to be upping the ante significantly. We're classifying them as high risk rescue scenarios. You know, you think of like pararescuemen jumping out of a C-130 and parachuting down to stabilize someone and prepare them for transport. You know, that's a lot of risk to that team. You know, we're really fortunate that we have those resources for when they're indicated, and they've been put to good use in recent years for sure. But I was stable at this point. We had a long list of injuries. We had a long list of anticipated problems, but I was stable. And so it wasn't the right situation to escalate it to one of those higher risk rescues. So without that kind of default one and not escalating to that next one, the decision was made that we would continue under our own power to try to get to Baker Lake, which was about 100 miles of paddling away from where we were. And that was almost all downriver. So it was a paddle that could be done in a few days. And so a lot of dominoes were put in place to, you know, prepare for that. And we were talking with medical control about, you know, what's that prolonged care management? What are some of those higher risk anticipated problems that we had to consider, like rabies? Which I think at the time it was still 100% fatal. And now it's like, there's a few instances where people haven't died, but you have to get that post-exposure series within a certain time period, and it has to be there, right?
Wow.
You know, if they don't have it, can't get it. So there were a lot of things that we were considering. You know, one of the benefits of staying with the group and continuing was that the likelihood of PTSD would decrease the longer I stayed with that group. And if you think about it, you know, of anyone in the world, they're probably the ones who understand most what I had just gone through and could, you know, maybe help with my processing it. So I feel really fortunate that, you know, the team that was looking into this situation was considering all the factors, you know, what's acutely a problem, but also what's something that could become a problem further down the line as well.
And you were able to paddle, at least. So you could, it wasn't like they had to get you somehow into the boat and do it entirely themselves. You could effectively contribute to your own rescue. Is that right?
Exactly. And that's a big factor. I mean, if this had been a backpacking trip, it would have been a different situation. You know,
you wouldn't have been carrying, able to walk
someone that distance is not realistic and not advisable. You can do something else, but yeah, you know, once they got me into the boat, I could help get us closer to Baker Lake, and I could, you know, like you said, assist with my own rescue, which was really empowering and cathartic for me. I'm always trying to figure out what is that action that I need to take to achieve the outcome that I'm looking for. Is there nothing I can do? Well, okay, then I'll try to step back. But if there's something that I can do that I can put into practice to change that outcome, that's where I want to put my focus. So being able to paddle was a big piece of that.
So at this stage, when you're like, so it took you a few days to get to the nearest town and you're paddling, did you start to wonder whether or not it had all been a dream? Because I mean, what you're describing is something completely surreal, and it all happened fairly quickly, right? I mean, obviously you've got the injuries, you know it did happen, but did it start to feel like, did that actually take place? Was I attacked by a bear?
A little bit. I mean, I think more for me, it was this indelible experience that just, it was kind of reappearing in ways that weren't flashbacks, but it was kind of applying to the world around me. I'd see boulders and think they were bears, and I would imagine them like jumping out of the water at me and all these things. So like there was this constant reminder that yes, this just happened. The pain of my leg, of course, is one thing as well. But I think the dream possibility was most manifest in imagining like other people's reaction. You know, when you think about what happened, it was me by myself on this hill. I was gone for minutes, essentially, from the rest of the group. And I come back with these injuries, and I was feeling like, you know, no one's going to believe me that this happened. And it's kind of this, I don't know if imposter syndrome, but, you know, this worry that maybe, you know, other people aren't going to believe that this terrible trauma happened to you, and that it happened the way that you remember it. And, you know, I think like the day after, I was able to ambulate on my own at this point on flat ground. And so I was like very, very hobbled, but I was limping around, and I was talking to Mike, and it might've been the next day, but it was not that long after. And I was like, you know, I almost wish there was like this set of claw marks on my forearm or something. Yeah. That, you know, people could look at and be like, oh yeah. You know, one of the, like the first reactions I often get when I'm talking to people in person and they hear that I was attacked by a grizzly bear, they look me up and down and they'll say something like, oh, I don't see any injuries, or, oh, you look great, or what have you. And all of my injuries are things that most people don't see. And, you know, that's a blessing. And it also has this, it like puts this burden of like, of conveying to people that this happened. And I guess I kind of recognized that would be a challenge early on.
You've written this wonderful book about the experience. You tell the story in, you know, really vivid detail. You kind of, just listening to you and reading your book, you know, it really puts you there in the terror of it all. But what's the bigger impact on you all these years, 18 years later? You know, on a surface level, this is a great boy's own story of kind of daring do and adventure and escaping death. But even though you were, and, you know, and as I understand it, you still are like a naturally adventurous person, you know, and you're able to laugh about a lot of this stuff now. What's the long-term impact on your psyche and your emotional life from going through something like that?
There are a few things I think that really stick with me, you know, some of the more like, I guess, expected, you know, I've had to come to terms with this experience and how it impacts me, especially with specifics around traveling in the wilderness. I knew early on that this could keep me from going out and doing these kinds of experiences. And I knew that that was something that I wanted to work through and to overcome so that I could go back out into the woods And I think that also played into feeling like I didn't want this experience to define me, which I've kind of come to terms with that as well. But as far as like getting back into the wilderness, I sort of micro-dosed myself to get back out there. So I would have situations that had a little more control, like starting out with a cabin not long after. And then like the next year when we went to the Boundary Waters for the first time, which is probably the most similar sort of situation where you're, you know, traveling by canoe in the backcountry under your own power in a wilderness area. I had all these different security blankets that I had to bring with me to make me feel more in control and prepared. So I wore like a tactical vest and I had bear spray and a machete and all kinds of kind of over the top things. But that's what I needed at that point to feel more comfortable. And over the years, I was able to, you know, get out there more and dial those things back to a more reasonable thing, and more reasonable level of gear that I bring for bears. And I was able to work on that enough so that I was able to go back to work at camp at Minogen and guide kids on their own transformational experiences in the wilderness, which was kind of a goal that I guess I had placed early on, that would be something that I would really find fulfilling and kind of bring things full circle in some ways. And then after that, I was able to come back and work with the St. Louis County Rescue Squad to do search and rescue in northern Minnesota, which has been really empowering in that I'm able to take these experiences and all this additional training that we go through and apply that to folks who are experiencing something perhaps, you know, along the lines of what I went through. So I'm able to apply that. I have a little bit different level of empathy with these folks and make a difference for them. So that's kind of the wilderness side of things. You know, on the other side, I've had a lot of, you know, I have a higher startle response, I guess. So like if a branch breaks as we're going out through the woods or whatever, I'm like instantly in, you know, identify what that is and figure it out. And my heart's just going crazy. And I'm figuring that out, you know, so that I can respond as needed. So that's been a challenge and that just kind of has lingered. But you know, being out and doing those things more has helped with that for sure. You know, one of the other things I think, one of the kind of big sort of intrinsic or subconscious things that I took away from this experience was this sense of purpose. And it gave me this strong feeling that things could have gone significantly differently up there. For one, all of the little things that had to align for me and the bear to be there at the same time is just like, there's a lot of kind of happenstance there, or, you know, whatever word you want to put on it. But then for it to play out the way that it did, and for me to survive, but also survive with as few injuries as I did, and to recover as well as I have, you know, it kind of imbued me with this sense of like, okay, that happened so that I can do something else in the future. And that's been a driving force, and it's been kind of a challenge at the same time, because I always feel like it's hard to figure out, to pinpoint, you know, and you rarely know all the ripple effects of something that you've done. So that's been part of the drive to do things like the rescue squad. But I've also felt like there's something bigger out there that I need to work towards. And I wanted to figure that out before I put this book out there. I wanted to be able to tie it up in a bow and present it and say, this happened, so that I could, you know, save this school bus full of children or whatever it is, you know, from the cliff. I don't know. Think of insert classic rescue, making a different situation there. What I realized, though, is that I could spend my entire life waiting to figure out what that purpose was and never publish the book, and I never tell this story. And I think that realization really shone a light on how I don't have to do that. I don't have to figure it out in order for the story to make an impact on other people and for them to take their own lessons from this experience. So that was when I decided that it was time to write the book and transfer that experience to other people.
Did you ever have counseling for PTSD or anything like that?
I didn't have formal counseling for PTSD. I think that was probably the biggest gap in my treatment. I think that when you deal with something like this, I think that should just be like part of the process. Like, you had this happen. Okay, we got to take care of your injuries. We also need you to talk to a professional resource about that. You know, I kind of talked a little bit about some of the steps that I took with family and friends to get myself back out there. And through the process of documenting what happened, I did a lot of the things that you end up doing with a professional, where you're doing like journaling and unpacking what happened so that you can better understand it, so that it's not going to jump out at you when you're not expecting it. So I kind of pieced together some of those techniques, I guess. But I think, you know, if I were to do it all again, I definitely would partner with some professionals early on to just, you know, have that go more smoothly and more quickly and make sure that we're not missing things, right?
And my last question is, do you still dream about the bear?
I do sometimes dream about the bear. Whether it's that bear or a different bear, my dreams are not usually replays of what happened. They're more like the bear is it's there and it's in a place that it shouldn't be. And the best example of that is was early on, and I've had similar ones since, but I was at camp within the weeks after. Sorry, there was a squeaking noise.
It's okay.
So I was in camp just weeks after the attack, and I was laying in a bunk, and within the room, I had this dream that was staged within the room, and there was this bear, this 600-pound bear, right next to me in the middle of the room, just breathing, and it's like this presence. And I've had dreams like that since, where I'm in the place where I am physically, and that's where the dream will manifest, and the bear is kind of there, or I'll have dreams of bears where they're like a pack of bears and they're doing non-bear things. But I've been really lucky in that I don't have a lot of those. It's more like when I'm visiting this memory a lot, then I'll have it. The most tangible example of that was when I was writing the actual bear attack. It was the last section that I wrote for the whole book, because I knew it was going to be the most challenging thing for me. And I spent a week up in the middle of the night writing about this terrible experience to the point, you know, at the depth where I can actually write down what happened in a way that's understandable. And that brought back a lot. But I also felt like after doing that and after completing all the process of writing the book, it's been a much less, it's happened a lot less. And it's almost like having that book now, I've got this experience that I can put on the shelf. And when I want to take it off and take a look at it, I can. But for the most part, it's just up there, and it's not going to come out at me.
Well, I'm really happy about that. It's a nice note to end it on. I'm happy for you. You seem like you're in a good place. And I just think that being able to, it's really interesting. You didn't do formal counseling, but I'm a big believer in people just acknowledging what they've been through, whatever it is. A lot of us don't, because everyone buries feelings and experiences and tell themselves they've got to be tough and they've got to just move on and push it down. And obviously you've been through something a lot more traumatic than most of us go through in our lives. And you found that just by getting it out and unpacking it, as you say, and facing up to it and acknowledging it and understanding that it would have had an impact on you, that in itself is extremely helpful. I think we can all learn something from that. I hope so, anyway.
Alex, thank you ever so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's an incredible story and you tell it really powerfully. And like I say, I think everyone can take a bit of inspiration and learning from your experiences, however unique they were. So thanks very much for your time. Best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
That was Alex Messenger. His book, The 29th Day, is fantastic and is out now. I will put a link to it in the blurb accompanying this show. Thanks for listening. And remember, if you don't already, subscribe to The Reset at samdelaney.substack.com. For just £5 a month, you can get access to a ton of podcasts, extra material, newsletters, and the occasional live stream too. Until next time, gang, thanks for listening. Be lucky and don't let the dickheads get you down.